Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have a great show for all of you today. Jennifer Gaddis, who was my guest last week talking about her book, The Labor of Lunch, is going to be returning today so that we can continue our conversation, because school lunch is an area that I am so passionate about, and there's so much to talk about, and we just did not even get halfway through the questions I wanted to ask Jennifer last week. So she'll be coming on again in just a little bit, but first I want to talk to you about some things going on in the news, some ways you can take action, and of course, share my weekly recipe with you. So in the news, I guess, you know, what is everyone talking about? We're still dealing with this virus, the pandemic that just does not seem to have an end in sight, and how schools are going to be returning in the fall is really a question. I know some schools, you know, down in Georgia, they're starting this week, and they're going back. And so, you know, there's just so many questions relating to bringing school back in the fall. And what is going to happen, even if we take all these precautions, what happens when a case actually breaks out, when someone in the school, which inevitably will happen, comes down with the virus? What then? Do we then close the school? Do you close for a day and we clean it? You know, do you just go on as if nothing happened? There's so many questions and nobody really knows the answers. It's all kind of guesswork. So I still don't know what my school district's going to be doing. I don't know if I'm going to be returning. I know that I would be comfortable going back into the school and making, delicious, locally sourced vegetable salad for them to put into bags of lunch. But I do also know I would not be comfortable going to each classroom or each cafeteria of every school in the district, you know, face to face with all 3,200 kids every week, and giving them samples. That wouldn't be okay. So there's a lot to still be decided. But what I did want to share with you is that I actually went into a Starbucks this past week, which was the first time I went anywhere other than a grocery store since this pandemic has really started. I mean, I've gone outside and, you know, hung out at the pool and whatever, but into a store. And, you know, it really hit me. I mean, it was the first time where I saw, you know, everybody was waiting online with like 4 to 6 feet between everybody. Everyone had masks on. You know, you ask for a taste and it's like, how do you taste something with and take your mask off while you're in the store to taste it? But anyway, then I went over to the garbage to throw my cup away and I was taken back for a minute. I had to stop because the garbage receptacle, instead of just being trash or recycle, it was trash. I mean, it was recycle or landfill. And I just loved it. I had to personally stop and think, is this cup at Starbucks recyclable? And I wasn't sure. Do I put this in recyclable or do I put this into the landfill and add to the landfill? And I think everyone, whether people are environmentalists or not, if it's put that way, nobody really wants to add to a landfill if they have a choice. So I feel like it really was making people stop and think about what they were throwing out and is this recyclable or am I going to add to the landfill? And I think we can really use more positive environmental marketing like that, not just environmental, positive marketing that helps people make better choices, like on half and half, if you said use half and half in your coffee every day, and that equals 5 pounds of weight a year. I don't know that nobody would do that because that's not going to help them sell half and half. But, you know, that kind of thing where you just, you know, the calories in stores really helped, you know, in Starbucks where you go in, you see how many calories, but so many people fought to undo that regulation. But those kind of things where you let people know the positive and or the negative of an action is really helpful in people making better choices. So I just wanted to commend Starbucks for that small little change, and I really hope to see more of that kind of marketing, you know, as we go forward. As far as take action this week, I only wrote about one thing, which was importing fracking waste into New York. You know, back in 2015, Governor Cuomo banned fracking in New York State. And that was a big win for New York State, and we were all so thrilled about it. However, he did nothing to stop the fracking infrastructure, you know, build the building of liquefied gas stations, or did he do anything to stop the importing of the fracking waste? And the fracking waste, a lot of the fracking waste is radioactive. It's filled with all these proprietary chemicals that they won't even tell us what they are, but they are super toxic, and they go into landfills unregulated. Unlike other waste that has to be regulated and monitored, fracking waste just goes right into the landfill, unregulated, radioactive or not. And they are even using a lot of this fracking waste because of the chemicals. It seems to melt ice, so they spray it on roadways. Long Island has banned that practice because of the sensitive water supply we have here in Long Island with the aquifers. But across the state, fracking waste is being used as a de-icer to de-ice the roads, and then it runs off onto the side of the roads and still gets into the water supply. So this is a practice we really want to stop. So please sign the petition that I have asking Governor Cuomo to ban the import of fracking waste into New York State, and also to ban any building of any infrastructure for more liquefied gas. We really need to invest in alternative energies. That's the way of the future. You know, we back almost a year now, we passed the Community Climate Protection Act, and that was a great big win for all of us, but we really need to start putting that into action and still allowing the building of fracking infrastructure is just going the wrong way. So we really need to invest in wind, in solar, in alternative energies, and, you know, start really changing the trajectory of where we're going. So I want to share my recipe this week with you. I have so many Asian greens coming out of my garden. So I had a lot of bok choy and napa cabbage, and I was making some Chinese-inspired food. And I wanted to make tofu with black bean sauce. And I know when I've ordered that in a restaurant, I know they use fermented black beans, and I didn't have anything like that. But I did have a can of black beans. And I did have a big jar of some homemade sauerkraut that I nurtured for or let ferment for over a month before putting it into my fridge. And I thought, oh, maybe I'll mix those things together. So I did. And it came out great. It's different than the black bean sauce you're going to get at your Chinese restaurant, but it was delicious. So this is a recipe for tofu medallions with a black bean sauce. And so for the tofu medallions, I used a cake of extra firm tofu that I sliced about a quarter inch thick each piece, and then I cut them on the diagonal so that they were little triangles or bigger triangles. A quarter cup of nutritional yeast, 1 teaspoon of onion powder, 1 teaspoon of garlic powder, 1 teaspoon of ginger powder, 1 teaspoon of Chinese spice powder. That's a 5 Chinese spice powder, and it's available in most specialty markets. A quarter teaspoon of cayenne pepper, which, of course, you can leave out if you don't like it spicy. A quarter teaspoon of salt, and then splashes of tamari to finish the baking. And then for the sauce, I use 2 tablespoons of canola oil, 1 onion chopped, 1 jalapeno pepper, and I use half of a red one and half of a green one for color, 1 teaspoon of minced garlic, 1 teaspoon of minced ginger, 1 can of black beans drained, 1 cup of sauerkraut, 1 tablespoon of tomato paste, another teaspoon of the 5 Chinese spice powder, 1 tablespoon of brown rice vinegar, 1 teaspoon of sesame oil, 1 teaspoon of hot sesame oil, Again, you can leave that out if you don't like spicy. 1 teaspoon of salt. Actually, I don't think that was a whole teaspoon of salt. Start with a half a teaspoon of salt and then see. My recipe needs adjusting here. 1/4 cup of boiling water and 1 tablespoon of chopped cilantro for garnish. So you start by laying out the tofu slices on a dry towel. Cover it with another towel and press slightly to dry it. And then, you know, whether you cut it first on the diagonal or not, you want to make sure you cut it on the diagonal to get those little triangles. Then I use a pie pan for this, but you can also use a deep plate. You're going to combine the nutritional yeast with all the spices. And then you're going to mix that up, and then you're going to dip each of the triangles of tofu into this nutritional yeast and spice mixture. You're going to cover a cookie sheet with parchment paper and spray it with some olive oil or canola oil, or just wipe it with a little oil. You're going to lay the tofu medallions out onto the greased parchment paper. And you can either dip the triangles into the nutritional yeast, or I'm remembering now, I actually just sprinkled it on both sides of the medallions. I baked it in the oven at 375 for about 10 minutes until the bottom was golden brown. Then I turned each slice over and baked it for another 5 minutes. And when you're ready to remove them from the oven, pull the cookie sheet out and splash some tamari on it. And then I turned the tofu over so that I could get the tamari on both sides of the tofu medallions. And while that was baking, I made the black bean sauce. And so I covered the bottom of a heavy skillet with the 2 tablespoons of oil. I added the onions, the ginger, and garlic and cooked that for a few minutes. Then I added the peppers, cooked it for another 5 minutes or so. Then I added the tomato paste and let that cook for another 5 minutes or so. And when you cook the tomato paste directly on the pan, it really brings out a deep umami flavor to the tomato paste. So it's not just acidic-y tomato paste. It really deepens the flavor by letting it saute a little bit first. Then I added the black beans and the sauerkraut and the Chinese 5-spice, the salt, the vinegar, and the sesame oils. I cooked that up a little bit. Then I used an immersion blender, and I pureed the black beans and sauerkraut. And I didn't puree it completely smooth. I wanted there to be some texture, and I wanted there to be a few black beans visible in the sauce. And then I added the boiling water 1 tablespoon at a time until I got to the consistency I wanted. And I think I might have used the whole 1/4 cup boiling water, but you can decide, you know, it depends how much liquid was in the sauerkraut. There's variables. So you want to just get to the right consistency. And when I say right consistency, you want to be able to put it on top of the tofu and have it be liquefied but not run off. So you want it to stay on top of the tofu but be able to dribble a little bit to the side in order to really feel like it's a sauce. And then if you have extra sauce, you can serve that on the side. And I serve this with my sautéed bok choy and napa cabbage and some brown rice, and it was just delicious. So I encourage you all to give it a try. It's really wonderful. And now is my pleasure to introduce my guest today. Jennifer Gaddis is the author of The Labor of Lunch, Why We Need Real Food and Real Jobs in American Public Schools. And Jennifer is an assistant professor of civil society and community studies at the University of Wisconsin. And she received a PhD in environmental studies from Yale University in 2014. And her research on school lunch programs has appeared in numerous journals, including Feminist Economics and the Journal of Agriculture, Food Systems and Community Development, and in popular media outlets such as the New York Times, the Washington Post, USA Today, and Teen Vogue. And our conversation last week was just so great, and I just did not get to finish all the questions I had for her, so I asked her to come back. So, Jennifer, are you with me?
Yes, I am. Thanks for having me back, Bunny.
Sure. So just in case we have people joining us who were not on the call last week, can you just give a very brief overall background of the history of the National School Lunch Program.
Sure. So as I mentioned last week, a lot of people talk about the National School Lunch Program as starting in 1946, right after the end of World War II, as really a way to not only help the American farm economy stabilize after the war, but also as a way to really address issues of malnutrition that became really, I think, kind of noticeable during the war, particularly during the draft. So this was a piece of legislation in 1946 that was passed with two purposes in mind. One was to support the health and well-being of the nation's children, and the other was to really bolster agriculture and food economies. But one of the things that I talk about in my book is that there's actually a 50-year history before that of really local experimentation at the kind of school, district, and state level that really built the infrastructure for this federal program to become possible in the first place. And the reason I really like to point out that history and also some of the kind of feminist roots behind it and all the women's work that went into it is because I think sometimes when we look at these big federal programs now, it can be hard to understand their history or hard to think that they're like changeable in any kind of way. So I think it's actually really important to understand that collective action, what we do as civil society really can be something that ultimately leads to, you know, these very large scale kinds of programs that maybe we take for granted today being created in the first place. So I think it's empowering for people to know that there is really this very local kind of effort that went into creating such a big national program that now feeds a little over 30 million kids each day. Well, not right now, some school closures, but in general.
Uh-huh. Yeah, well, I was actually just reading such a disturbing article in, you know, they're talking about the longest summer, childhood hunger in the wake of coronavirus. And since school closings, you know, so many kids really do depend on the school lunch program. And with people losing their jobs who were already, even before the pandemic, living on the edge. Now, this has just really pushed them over. And so many kids are just hungry. They're not getting enough food. I mean, there's, you know, typically in the summer, participation in school lunch programs always go down. You know, very, you know, some schools make school lunch programs available in the summer, but it's a challenge, and you really need to have a parent who's, you know, really savvy to find out where they're being distributed and where they can continue to get food. But right now, with the schools closed, you know, I was just reading, it's so sad how many kids are really hungry, and you know, how the, you know, the summer programs are just not filling the gap as much as it needs to.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I think just to kind of back up for a second, in case listeners aren't aware of this, so the way that the National School Lunch and Breakfast Programs work now is that kids qualify for either free, reduced price, or what are called paid lunches based on their family income. So all of these lunches are subsidized to some extent by the federal government. It's just the degree is different based on economic need. So for those kids whose families are at, my brain's not working for a second. For those families that are at 130 to 185% of the federal poverty rate, they would pay 40 cents for lunch. And for those families whose kids are 130% or below the federal poverty rate, they would get free school meals. So school meals really are an important economic subsidy, particularly for families that really are in low-wage jobs, which we have so many of in the U.S. So I think one of the big challenges really throughout the pandemic has been that a lot of families have not only seen their own earnings go down, but have seen you know, this economic subsidy that they could depend on during the school year really disappear in a lot of places. And a lot of schools have done like a really valiant effort to continue serving meals, but certainly the number of meals that they're serving is lower. And one thing that I would encourage listeners to do is if you are in a situation where you yourself or you know people who are really struggling, whose kids would potentially qualify for free or reduced price meals, do make sure that they are enrolled for the upcoming academic semester. Sorry, I say semester because I think my brain is in my teaching mode. Academic year. And also if your state has made what's called pandemic EBT available, make sure to apply for that. I know where I am in Wisconsin that this upcoming Friday is actually the deadline for the application. But pandemic EBT is essentially like a SNAP debit card that would go to families whose kids qualify for free or reduced price meals to help them offset the financial loss that they've had if their schools weren't serving meals. So pandemic EBT, look into eligibility for that. And also, you know, people are interested in this outside of pandemic times. Food insecurity, particularly among children, is always higher in the summer. So there's a lot of advocacy work that people can do to try to really bring more resources to the summer feeding program so that school districts can have more sites and make food more available to kids.
Yeah, that was one of the struggles our school district had, was they were distributing only from the high school, and there were a lot of kids that couldn't get there. You know, the parents did work, or, you know, or, I mean, it was only a 2-hour window also of when you could pick up. So it wasn't, you know, it didn't make it very easy for some families. And I think they actually started doing some deliveries because there were families that they knew of that just could not get there. And luckily, there were some volunteers that were willing to do some deliveries. But the pandemic EBT, I actually wrote about last week because it's ending tomorrow, right? Or the application?
You know, I haven't looked so much.
Or was it even last
all the different states, but I know for sure that in Wisconsin, the application window closes tomorrow.
Yeah.
So it's certainly worth looking into.
Yeah, I think it was the same for New York. So, yeah. So anyway, so last week we were talking about, you know, some model programs that you wrote about in your book in other countries, Japan and Finland and Brazil for a few of them. But what are the biggest obstacles in this country to get the school lunch programs healthier? And when I say healthier, I mean real food, like real cooking, not just unpacking boxes and laying them out on cookie sheets and baking them in the oven. What is the real challenges in making that happen?
Well, I think part of it is really cultural. And really, ever since we started to have not-for-profit school food programs in the U.S., and we've had them for well over 100 years, they've always been treated as different from the rest of the school day. So, like, you walk into the cafeteria and maybe there's some kind of public assistance, but lots of people are just going to be paying for their lunch and eating it there. It's not really treated as like an educational part of the school day, and it's not publicly funded by state and local tax dollars in the same way that, you know, math or English classes would be. So we have always kind of had this situation in the United States where we treat kids differently based on their economic class when they come into the school cafeteria. And, you know, I think that certainly there's a lot of racism in classism that plays out in schools, but you certainly aren't charging people an entry fee when they come into, you know, their math class at that kind of point of, you know, entering the door in the same way that you do in the cafeteria. So I think for a long time, we've really had this expectation in the U.S. that our school food programs should be financially self-supporting and that education doesn't really happen there. And I think a lot of the countries that have really wonderful school lunch programs, they treat school food differently. They see the educational potential and how it's not only really important for young people to learn about nutrition and to learn about the environment and to learn about, you know, the economy and work and labor. Like, there's just so many things that you can learn, not to mention, you know, diverse food cultures through school lunch. But we don't really do it for the most part in the United States. Instead, we're stuck in this trap of, you know, really, for the most part, thinking about school food more as a social welfare provision. And I think that that's one of the big things that makes it really difficult to advance change in the U.S. So I mentioned earlier that there is this three-tiered system of eligibility in the U.S., of free, reduced price, or paid meals. One thing that I think makes a really big difference is when school lunch programs are universal, meaning everybody participates, and ideally when they're universally free, that creates a lot more, I think, incentive for people to really invest in making these programs very high quality. But instead, what we have in the United States is we have about 20 million kids who have access to these school meals in their public schools, who aren't eating them, who oftentimes are either bringing lunch from home or going off campus if that's allowable to them, or purchasing some sort of food on the a la carte line. And those kids are disproportionately from upper middle class and middle class families. So I think one of the big things that we have in the U.S. is because participating in the kind of government subsidized school lunch program is optional. I think that we have a lot of upper middle class and middle class families who just generationally haven't really participated in the program, and don't necessarily see their own self-interest reflected in paying attention to the program and fighting to make it better for all kids. So I really hope that as there seems to be at least some glimmer of awakening in terms of, just mainstream attention to racial justice issues. And I think, there were even in the last kind of cycle of Democratic presidential debates, there's a lot more attention to economic inequality. So I'm hoping as more and more people really start to think about economic and racial injustice, they'll start to also kind of think about how our institutions and public programs propagate these kinds of injustices, and how sometimes things that seem individually good decisions might actually be just making the problem worse. So I think my short answer is really that in the U.S., until we can figure out how to get upper middle class and middle class families to opt into this program and have their kids participate, it's going to be really challenging to fully kind of maximize the public good of the program, or to even really just get what a lot of people would just refer to as real food in schools, because that takes oftentimes added investment in terms of infrastructure. If schools aren't set up to do cooking, schools might need more equipment, and they certainly need more labor hours for doing scratch cooking. And if they're doing any kind of what people call values-based sourcing, so sourcing from local smaller scale farms, or trying to get produce from minority-owned farms, or trying to specifically, if they're getting products that are made outside of the U.S., going through fair trade kind of supply chains, all those kinds of things typically cost more money. So I think that until we can really get this chunk of 20 million kids whose parents maybe have a little bit more economic clout to care about changing this program, I think it's going to be really challenging at the national level. So we do see lots of good examples of change happening at the local level, which is awesome. We need that in terms of pointing the way forward. But I think that we also need to make sure that we're really focused on how do we actually change this big national program so we don't create all these kind of pockets of inequality in terms of how it actually operates across the country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One thing we had talked about, and you talked about in your book a bit, so many schools have gone to food service contracts as opposed to having the lunch lady do the cooking. I mean, you still have the lunch ladies serving it up, but even the lunch ladies very often are employees of the food service company now. They're not employees of the school. Can you talk a little bit about, and I also know you also said that, the food service now, it's not supposed to be for profit, but it seems to me like a lot of schools, will allow Coca-Cola to buy a banner for their, sports field in order to advertise Coca-Cola, even if they can't have Coca-Cola advertising in the cafeteria itself, that they get money that way. Can you talk a little bit about the difference between a school lunch program that is self-supported within the district versus contracting out to these food service conglomerates?
Sure. So first, what I would say is when a school district decides that it's going to offer meal service to students into families, they first make the decision of whether or not they want to participate in the federal school lunch program and the federal school breakfast program. Both of these things are optional. So school food authorities don't have to necessarily do it. And one of the things that we have seen after 2012, when nutrition regulations got a little bit tighter, was that there were some very affluent school districts that just decided, hey, you know, it's not really worth it for us to participate in this program. We don't really have very many kids who qualify for free or reduced price meals. We're stopping. So schools have the choice of whether or not they want to participate in this program. If they
really? I actually didn't know that. I thought every school has to.
Huh. They do not have to participate. No. And I think that's a big thing also, like in private schools in particular, is you'll see that public schools participate at a much higher rate than private schools in the National School Lunch and Breakfast Program. So once schools decide, yes, I do want to participate in this federal program, what will end up happening is they can decide, well, we are going to just run everything ourselves. So as the Board of Education, we're going to hire like our food service director, and we're going to hire like all of our staff, and we're going to manage like everything internally. If they don't want to do that, if that seems like something that they feel is outside of their zone of expertise, or maybe they've done that in the past and feel like for some reason it's not working for them, they are allowed to contract out their operation with a food service management company. So a food service management company is a for-profit entity. Some of the most kind of widely known food service management companies are Aramark, Chartwell's, and Sodexo. They hold contracts not only with K-12 schools, also other kinds of institutional food service like hospitals and correctional facilities and university and college dining halls. So these food service management companies are typically, they're not all really large. Some are regional, but the ones that are kind of the most powerful that really, I think, drive a lot of that industry are large multinational corporations that have their sort of fingers in, I would say, a lot of different arenas in which people are eating. So these food service management companies, they are supposed to exist and somehow derive profit within what is a not-for-profit program. So there's really like two ways in which they can do that. One is by somehow reducing the cost of the food. So one way that they can do this is potentially by using the fact that they are really large to get rebates from manufacturers or to negotiate kind of lower prices since they're purchasing in such large volumes. Another way is instead of decreasing the cost, increasing revenue by getting like kids to kind of buy more extra things. So that's where a lot of these food service management companies really came under a lot of criticism in the 1990s and early 2000s for trying to get kids to kind of buy a lot of unhealthy snacks through the a la carte line, because that was seen as like a real moneymaker. And besides the food costs, the other area that they can really see, some potential for carving out a profit for themselves is if they can figure out ways to reduce labor costs. So this is like a big thing that we see documented in the literature. Essentially, food service workers who are contracted out to these food service management companies instead of directly hired by their local school board make lower wages and tend to have fewer benefits and in general like worse benefit packages. And I think that is something that we have to take really seriously, because it's basically a form of like extracting wealth from communities. Like those food service workers like live and work most often like in the communities that they're serving, and they're seeing, you know, their wages decreased, likely their own kids probably qualify for free or reduced price lunches, and instead that wealth is going off to these food service management companies. So a lot of the people from food service management companies would say, well, it's not really that simple, because we also, you know, provide value to these school districts. Like typically they call us in when, you know, they're in the red and they want to figure out a way to like get back up to, you know, being revenue neutral. So they say that they bring a lot of expertise in terms of, you know, how to think about like the logistics and the management, because they're doing this kind of work in so many different locations. So they kind of say, well, you know, we can learn from all these different places in which we're doing food service. We can bring the best kind of ideas here. And we also have like all these professionals thinking about, you know, marketing and other kinds of things, so we can bring that expertise to your district. So they have like some, I think, selling points that sort of make contracting out sound good. And that's why somewhere between like 17 to 20% of school districts have actually contracted with these types of companies. But I think that there are some hidden costs, particularly to public health and to worker welfare, that need to be taken into account when making that kind of decision.
Mm-hmm. But doesn't bringing in a food service contract company cost the district more money? I mean, it's not supposed to be profitable. No?
It depends. I mean, I think that there's examples where the food service management company is able to just run the program for the same cost, or maybe I would say like the same cost as it might be for them to do their own meal program. And there are certainly instances where like the food service management company will promise that, you know, they can deliver cost savings, or they can make everything that the district wants happen within a certain price point, and then they go like over budget. Like, that definitely happens. But there's not necessarily like a guarantee that it's going to cost the district more money, because in theory, the district would still be hiring like their own staff to do all the kind of administrative and logistics and ordering work that the management company is doing, and all the HR stuff. So they would be hiring their own people. And instead what they're doing is they're providing basically a fee for service to the food service management company.
Mm-hmm. Right. Let's take a couple minute break. And when we come back, I'd like to talk about the idea of every school having their own kitchen, or whether it's more cost effective having a general commissary and then, you know, sending the food to the different schools. So everyone listening, don't go anywhere. If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Jennifer Gaddis, author of The Labor of Lunch. Be right back.
Stay up to date with PRN for the latest on the coronavirus. Learn ways to stay spiritually vibrant and physically strong on PRN.FM, the Progressive Radio Network.
This is the theme music for the Hour of Lateral Thinking.
A conversational amusement, streaming Mondays at 5 p.m. Eastern here on PRN.
Lateral thinking is sideways thinking.
It's not necessarily logical.
Its conclusions, if any, are unforeseen. I'm Janet Coleman.
I'm David Dozer,
the displaced playwright on each show.
Along with Chris Cerf, David Finkel, Maggie Paley, and musical perpetrator Bob Auld,
we address such topics as haircuts, rain, soup, pretentiousness.
Are you dying of ennui?
My Ferrari is in the shop.
So use the Rolls Royce.
The Hour of Lateral Thinking.
Mondays at 5 p.m. Eastern, here on PRN.
Hi, I'm Gary Knoll. Houston, we have a problem. We have a lot of problems in our society today. The issue is that here at the Progressive Radio Network, we take an honest, objective, and fair-minded look at these problems and then come up with positive solutions. You'll hear Ralph Nader. You'll hear Jimmy Dore. You'll hear Utrice Lead and Gerald Salante. In fact, you'll hear more than 80 different individuals, all of whom have over decades of their life shown that they care first and foremost about helping challenge all of the corruption, the malfeasance, the psychopaths in our society. These are people who have rushed towards the crisis. These are our intellectual and activist first responders. So if you want a place to listen, to hear the truth when there's so much fake news, Progressive Radio Network is that place. Thank you.
Hello, everyone. everyone, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And my guest today is Jennifer Gaddis. She's the author of The Labor of Lunch, Why We Need Real Food and Real Jobs in American Public Schools. And right before the break, I was asking her the difference and the benefits for in having one central kitchen in a school district versus separate kitchens in each school. So, Jennifer, I know that's something that, you know, I've been looking at within our school district. You know, some of the schools have kitchens, some of them don't have kitchens. And right now, you know, they cook some stuff in the high school and they bring it to a couple of the elementary schools that don't have kitchens. And then, you know, the middle school has their own kitchen. So it's a mishmash. It's a mixture in our school district. Has there been a study done what did you find as far as school districts that have one main commissary where they do all the cooking and then they truck the food to the different schools versus cooking in each school separately?
Yeah, that's a really great question that is more complex than it first seems, and I'm happy to dig into that in just a second. But I just wanted to quickly address, during the break, I just did a quick little Google search, and I actually found, so earlier I had mentioned that participation in the National School Lunch Program is optional, and I just wanted to say that that's true at the federal level. There's no federal mandate that all schools have to participate, but I did just want to clarify in case any listeners are like, well, that doesn't seem true, that it's actually a state level decision. So there's no federal requirement, but individual states may actually require all of their public schools to participate in the program.
Uh-huh.
So if you see any kind of thing happening like that around you, it's a state level decision, not a federal decision.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for clarifying that.
Yeah, no problem. So as far as the on-site versus central kitchen question goes, I think that there are some important factors to consider. So a central kitchen is definitely something that I think can be used to prepare food from scratch using basic ingredients. But depending upon how a district is sending out the meals, you can have really different results. So some places will serve meals in those kind of hotel pans. So they're basically sending out large quantities of things that will be dished out in the cafeteria. And it kind of looks like traditional cafeteria service, like the kids or teachers or whoever are eating in the cafeteria may really have no idea that it's not actually being cooked at that particular school site. The other way in which central kitchens will package the food is in basically these little pre-packed TV dinner style meals. And I think that those types of meals tend to be really associated with poor just food quality in terms of not only the appearance and after what things look like when they have been cooked in advance, cooled down, and then reheated, but also when you have these different food components in the compartment, sometimes they actually would be ideally cooked using different kinds of techniques. So when you just reheat them all together, you can have moisture migration and stuff like that. It just ends up making the textures not particularly tasty. So mm-hmm. I think that there's a big difference between the pre-packed kitchen model and sending things out in bulk. But I personally think that the way to go is to really invest in building on-site kitchens. So if a district has a central kitchen, using it more as a food hub for aggregating food from different suppliers and maybe doing some pre-processing work. It's a little harder for on-site schools to, for instance, dice up butternut squash or chopped up carrots or things like that. So if a central kitchen has a piece of equipment that's going to make just doing that really fast. I think sending schools stuff that are essentially just minimally processed ingredients to make it a little easier for them to cook is a really great way to use a central kitchen, or making scratch prepared sauces or dressings or things like that. I'm less of a fan of preparing the entire meals there, in part because I think it's actually really important with on-site kitchens to recognize that when you are shipping food from one location, whether it's prepared food from a central kitchen, or you're just receiving food that is essentially like shelf stable or frozen pre-made food from a manufacturer, what you're doing is you're creating a ton of 3 to 5 hour part-time jobs. So just because a school is actually quote unquote cooking on site doesn't necessarily mean they're cooking from scratch. For me, like on-site cooking, like really needs to be accompanied with this transition to scratch cooking, because that's where we start to see all these possibilities open up, not only in terms of like making sure that we're using public dollars to support smaller scale farmers, minority growers, you know, just really diversifying and making our food system more resilient. But also that's really how we start to move from having all these really short hour, de-skilled kind of positions where workers are just reheating food, to actually having full-time jobs, career mobility that allow kitchen and cafeteria workers to stay in these jobs over an extended period of time and actually care for themselves and their families with the wages that they bring home. So my kind of big argument against continuing the central kitchen model, even if you are, you know, doing scratch cooking in the central kitchen and all of that, is that you still just have so many people who are in these very, very part-time positions. And I think that as a society, we really need to move away from having, you know, two or three jobs be what's necessary for people to barely get by. So one of the things that was really powerful for me to see is in districts like Minneapolis and Minnesota, they actually, over the kind of 6 years or so that I was doing research in that district, were transitioning away from this central kitchen model that they'd had since the 1970s of sending out the little TV dinner style meals to all of their schools, to actually investing in building out kitchens and increasing the culinary skills of their staff. And this enabled them to do so much more in terms of farm-to-school sourcing and phasing out what people in the industry often refer to as ingredients of concern from their school meals. So they were able to make food, you know, they call it true food, but it's basically just real food or clean food by any other name. And the big thing that they saw is as they were moving away from the central kitchen model and to on-site from scratch cooking, is that they were able to recruit and retain workers much, much more easily. And people like felt proud of working in the school district and felt like they were really part of the movement. And a lot of the workers that I interviewed there also told me that you know, for the first time, they were actually seeing teachers come into the cafeteria and want to eat there, and teachers were complimenting them on the food. So I think that there's a lot that investing in workers to do on-site cooking can do for, like, the culture of school food. And the other thing that I would add in relation to that is that there can be a lot of variation, especially in larger school districts, in terms of what the particular school population looks like demographically. So when you have the ability to actually cook from scratch at the like local level of a single school building, you have a lot more freedom to actually be responsive to like the cultural needs and preferences of the community that you're serving. So I think in general, I'm a real fan of on-site from scratch cooking model. But I do think particularly for places that already have central kitchens, there are like cool creative ways to use them in support of this like broader idea of a real food economy. Just continuing with this example of Minneapolis, they've actually gotten some equipment grants. And one of the things that they're doing is they're doing that kind of pre-processing of farm to school vegetables. And they recognize that as a large district, like the largest district in their state, that they can actually play an important role as a food hub for helping smaller school districts get the kind of food that you know, they want to be serving in their schools. So they can actually start to not only process farm-to-school veggies for their own schools, but also, like, you know, send some of these minimally prepared foods to other schools as well to really help them increase their ability to serve local food.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I'd also like to just talk to my listeners a little bit about the difference between scratch cooking that is completely from start versus minimal scratch cooking, where you talk about it in your book, where you know you might make burritos and you might use a number 10 can of black beans and already pre-grated cheese, so you have some shortcuts. You don't have to cook the beans from scratch, but you're still then seasoning and making the dish yourself as opposed to buying frozen burritos, for instance.
Right, yeah. People in the industry typically refer to that as speed scratch or quick scratch. And I think that that can be like a good transition strategy, and it can be something that really helps build confidence, particularly if a lot of the workers in a school food program have really been used to over time just making, taking food out of boxes, reheating it, and serving it. Like, it can give them, I think, a little bit easier of a pathway, feeling like confident about making food from scratch for hundreds or thousands of people at a time. Because that's something mm-hmm. that I think is important to remember, is that, you know, a lot of people might be just fine home cooks, but, preparing food under a really tight time schedule for hundreds of thousands of people at a time is like a whole different animal in terms of like the challenges that it presents. So I think that that can be a helpful thing to kind of build up capacity. But I think that if we view that as the end point of school food reform, or, you know, what real food looks like in schools, I think that that's kind of a danger, because with a lot of this, like speed scratch cooking, unless you have a district like Minneapolis that has a central kitchen where they're really acting as a food hub to produce these very high quality, like ingredients that are sourced using these values-based principles, you, I think, are going to have a harder time really supporting like local food economies using speed scratch cooking. It's like you might be able to, I think, make the food a little healthier, a little fresher, a little bit more appealing, but you'll still be pretty much tied to like the industrial, like national or even multinational like supply chain. So I do think that you have to kind of think about either doing like, you know, more basic forms of preparation, or having some sort of facility that can help with some of the pre-processing if you want to go like the speed scratch model and still have that aspect of really using school food as an opportunity to support local and sustainable food systems.
Right, right. What else did I want to talk about? There's been a real movement, as we've talked about and you've mentioned in your book, about moving towards farm-to-school programs. How many of the schools that you got to look at actually take the farm-to-school model and bring it into like a garden in the school as well as just in the cafeteria? Like, do they take the farm-to-school programs outside of the cafeteria?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think certainly in some districts they have not only really wonderful school gardens where they might even be having some of the food that kids are growing in the gardens be used in the cafeterias, but also I think depending upon whether a district is rural or suburban or urban, you might also have like pretty active like FAA chapters or things like that where students actually have like a district farm or like raise livestock. And I think that there's so many different kinds of nonprofits these days that really work to support the educational side of farm to school. And for instance, like one big national service organization, Food Corps, they have service members in a lot of lower income schools across the country that specifically really are working on this educational side and experiential learning in relation to farm to school. But I think a big problem there is that a lot of these efforts, they aren't really equally accessible to students across like school districts or across grade levels. So students might have some opportunities to participate, like if they're lucky. But I think because we don't really have strong federal standards or even state standards for nutrition education in this country, a lot of the efforts that we see are grant funded, or there's efforts of like particularly motivated teachers or parents. And like, you know, a lot of these initiatives really struggle in terms of, I think, their duration and their reach, because they aren't really integrated into like the fabric of public schooling. So some of the most successful examples I've seen have really figured out ways to tie themselves to like the curriculums that teachers like have to hit on in order to meet state standards. And I think that that's been like a real kind of push from a lot of the nonprofits that work to support this movement, is to figure out, you know, how do we create as many lessons as possible that teachers can kind of plug into their existing curriculum, so that it's not something that they feel like they have to start from scratch in order to do. But, you know, I think all these things are really awesome, but what we really do need is some sort of, I think, national expectation that, like, learning about nutrition, having experiential education in the garden are important things for students to learn. There was actually a bill that Cory Booker, I can't remember who else, introduced earlier this year. And I think that this bill, were to actually be passed, is something that would, I think, benefit a lot of schools in terms of really helping them have some resources to establish some pilot programs that focus more on this type of experiential education, so that ideally it could at some point really be rolled out across the country, like through the public school infrastructure, and not so dependent on just individual like champions or nonprofits to include.
Yeah, that's one of the downsides, I think, right now. One of the many downsides of what's going on with everyone having to learn now online with Zoom classes. I mean, there's so many different types of kids, as we know, and they're all so many different types of learners. And for many kids, it's very hard to, you know, learn just from, you know, sitting in front of a screen. So many
Absolutely.
Kids learn better with hands-on and experiential. And I would have found it a real challenge.
I was just going to say, I do know that there are two organizations that I would point listeners to if they feel like, you know, they want to provide this kind of educational content, but are restricted by just lack of being able to meet in person. So both the Edible Schoolyard Project and Food Corps have developed some online lessons, or some kind of lessons that I think are delivered online, but really get kids like active within like their own home spaces. And a lot of those resources are available for free online at their website. So I think that those are organizations that are definitely good ones to look to for ideas for content.
Yeah. Wow, we're out of time again. Well, Jennifer, thank you so much for coming
You're
back
welcome.
On and sharing your passion with me. We share that passion, and I hope this new school year produces some positive results. We'll see what happens.
Me too.
But
thank you so much.
You're welcome. And everyone out there, I actually did not mention that this is my last show until September. I'm taking the month of August off, celebrating my 10 years here at PRN. So I will see you all again on September, what is the date of it? September 3rd, I believe. So everyone have a great month of August, and I will see you again, yes, on September 3rd. Bye for now. Thank you, Jennifer.